Welcome to ASME TechCast, where we bring you the innovators, the innovations, and the issues that push the envelope of engineering. My name is Jeffrey Winters, Editor-in-Chief at Mechanical Engineering Magazine. Today, we are talking about space exploration and the engineering workforce with Elizabeth Jens. Dr. Jens is a propulsion and systems engineer at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Dr. Jens, welcome to the big show.
Thank you for having me here.
Oh, it's my pleasure, believe you me. Now, as all of you out in podcast land certainly know, Mars has been a longstanding target for exploration. There have been stories written and mission plans written up for sending astronauts to Mars for decades. But Mars, well, Mars is a lousy place for people. The air is thin, the soil is toxic, and it takes months to reach it with conventional rocket technology. That's why, since 1976, robotic spacecraft have been exploring the Martian surface for us. But that's not to say that humans aren't involved. Behind every lander, rover, and Mars copter is an army of engineers designing every part and testing every system. And that's where Dr. Jens comes in. She's a mechanical engineer who is the cognizant engineer for the gaseous dust removal tool on the turret of the Perseverance rover, which landed in 2021. And she has worked on technology development for hybrid propulsion systems and on the propulsion system for the proposed Mars sample return campaign, which I think we're all looking forward to get those Mars rocks back. So hopefully we can get that going soon. Dr. Jens is also the former chair of ASME's Propulsion Technology Committee and is the current vice chair of the ASME Aerospace Division Executive Committee. So we're going to be talking a bit about the engineering role in these space missions, and as well as what it's like to be an engineer at JPL. So ready or not, we're digging in. So first of all, I have to say this role of cognizant engineer is new to me. As I understand it, the role is to facilitate the development of spacecraft subsystems and be the go-to expert for mechanisms or some portion of the flight project or complex engineering project. And obviously, I'm missing some nuance here. So can you please help better explain what a cognizant engineer is and the role that they play? And also, before we begin, I guess you have to tell us about what JPL wants to say at the outset, right?
Yeah, so I'll start by just saying that all of the discussion here is my point of view and not necessarily the opinion of JPL. But the cognizant engineer terminology, it's something that we use across the lab. And I'm not sure if others use it, but it's equivalent to like a responsible engineer. So essentially, if you have a component, a part that gets complicated enough, then we'll usually assign a cognizant engineer to that part. And that person is the go-to point of contact for that hardware. So they become the technical authority on it. They're the person who's responsible for ensuring that it's delivered. And then the person that really is the point of contact if there's issues with it after delivery. So in my case, it was going through, you know, initial brainstorming for what my piece of hardware was going to look like, through development testing of that, design, purchasing of all of the different subcomponents of it. I had a team that I worked with for the overall development and build, but I still get contacted now. So my hardware is on the Perseverance rover. And if there is an issue, or even if things are going well, and the operations team just want to touch base about the results that they're getting, I'm still the point of contact. And so if you're the cognizant engineer for some hardware, you're kind of expected to be the go-to person. And you could be the go-to person 15 years later if an issue comes up, or 20 years later, or, you know, an entire career later if there's a problem. And so I kind of love it because it forces you to really know the nuances of all aspects of your hardware. We have dedicated technical experts at the lab that we can reach out to when we have specific problems. But we're expected as the cognizant engineer to synthesize that information and work out, right, given that input, what's the best path forward? How do I produce hardware that's going to work, and how do I debug problems if they come up,
Right.
which inevitably they do.
I mean, it almost sounds like there's a blurring of a boundary between you and the actual technology. You're sort of like the human embodiment of this technology, and you know the whole thing inside and out.
Yeah, essentially that's the ideal of it, right? Is that, yeah, you are the person who can be pinged on any question. And then even if you don't know the answer, you're expected to be the one to chase it down and really see it through.
Okay. That's an amazing role. I've never heard of anything like that before. That's cool. So the Perseverance rover, and I always call it Perseverance. I know it's supposed to be Perseverance. Perseverance rover is a robotic geology platform that goes to the rocks and drills away the surface layers to expose the minerals below, so that there are other instruments that can go and see what those minerals are made out of. But to get a really good look at those layers, any of the dust or cuttings need to be removed, which is where the gaseous dust removal tool that you worked on comes in. So can you tell us a little bit about the role that you played in the development of that tool, and even more so, how does it work?
Sure. I'll say this. So the reason we even need something like this is the rocks that the science community are interested in are generally beneath that red, rusty, oxidized layer. And so the way we get to the rock beneath there is to use an abrasion tool. And so we had a team at JPL that had been planned, sort of from the outset to develop a tool that was going to abrade away that top surface of rock, but that produces a pile of dust. And what we used on the Curiosity rover was a brush-based tool that would spin a brush around and attempt to remove the dust. But the challenge there is that brushes actually, work because they move the air that then moves the dust. And in an environment like Mars, where you've got really low density, low pressure, that type of mechanism doesn't work so well. The joy from my point of view is that using something like a compressed gas system actually works really quite well. So I got brought on fairly late in the development of Percy overall, where there was challenges where our engineering team couldn't meet the science requirements for having a clear surface that could be imaged by the instruments on the rover. And specifically, it was Sherlock and Pixel who needed to take these really clear images of this rock surface. And so I was asked to look at what we could do with a gas system to move away that dust and hopefully get a really clear image of the rock beneath. And it's wonderful when you get given a problem where your skill set, in my case, with pressurized systems and propulsion systems applied really well to the problem at hand. And so we have a little compressed gas system that uses ultra clean nitrogen, or sort of the cleanest nitrogen we could get on Earth. And that's so that we don't contaminate those rock surfaces with anything we're taking from Earth. And we puff gas to clear away the dust. The challenge that we had was we want to use the smallest amount of gas that we can because it's a finite resource that we've carried from Earth. And yet we want to clear a reasonably large sized abrasion. And so we had to do a bit of development where we were iterating on nozzle designs and pressures and things to try to come up with a design that would meet the requirements, but would also be capable of doing a whole lot of puffs. We also needed to make sure that we weren't puffing too hard, and for really soft rock surfaces, potentially, ruining that beautifully smooth abraded surface that our drill was producing. And so we did a bunch of iterations and testing. We moved into test really quickly. I think I got brought on, and within a week, we were in a vacuum chamber testing and iterating on the design. And within a couple of years, we had procured all the components, assembled the system, put it through a full test campaign, and delivered it to the rover. So it was kind of a fun couple of years.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned it's a finite resource. I mean, that's only going to work as long as the tank has nitrogen in it. Did you have a set number of samples that you need to meet? And I know the perseverance has been up there for a while. Have you reached that limit, or is there still more gas in the tank, as they say?
We still have lots more gas in the tank, thankfully. So when we designed it, we actually put a 4x margin on the number of abrasions we were going to try and clear. And so one of the challenges was we were having to go through this design cycle pretty quickly. And the requirements, we were producing the requirements at the same time that we were producing the hardware, which is not an ideal se sequence of events, but when we had a baseline design, which was this brush-based tool, and then it didn't meet the requirements. We had to rapidly iterate. So we put a 4x margin on the amount of gas that we were designing to. The upside of that is that as it allows us to potentially use the gas to clear other surfaces that weren't part of our baseline design. And so as we go into extended missions and things, we can maybe use that gas to clear free surfaces and other things that are of scientific interest but weren't necessarily part of the hard requirements in the design phase. So yeah, we have plenty of gas, thankfully. And we also had to design, accounting for a potential for leak and things like that. And so we tried to ensure that we'd have plenty of gas that would have a robust system that would see us through the full science mission that Percy's out there completing.
I mean, that's amazing work. It's amazing that here it is, like 3 years later, and since landing, and it's still working. So that's cool. You've also worked on the technology development for hybrid propulsion systems, and on the actual propulsion system for a proposed Mars sample return campaign. I mean, how's that the hybrid? I mean, how's that different than the sort of systems that we've sent to Mars up to now, in terms of, requirements and the sort of challenges involved in that?
Yeah, I guess I'll step back a bit, Jeffrey, if that's all right, and just explain generally how we classify these propulsion systems. It's actually really simple, except that most people hear hybrid and think now of like electric cars and things. And hybrid rockets are quite different. So we classify our rockets, our propulsion systems, in terms of the phase of the propellants. So solid rocket systems use solid fuel and oxidizer premixed together. Then we have liquid propulsion systems. They're using liquid fuel and oxidizer. And then monopropellant systems are just using a single monopropellant, which is generally a liquid. Hybrids use propellants that are in different phases. Typically, you will use a solid fuel and a liquid or gaseous oxidizer with that fuel. Hybrids in general are at a lower technology readiness level than their counterpart solid and liquid systems. And so they're an active area of research. So the universities around the world have been really actively developing these systems. In part, it's because there's relatively benign fuel and oxidizers that you can work with. And also just generally, there hasn't been the technology investment that has been in liquid rockets, liquid bipropellant rockets, monopropellant systems, solid rockets. And so there's real potential there for sort of rapid development and growth. JPL was looking at them with kind of unique, for unique applications, I would say. So one potential application is missions where you need the ability to store your propulsion system at really cold temperatures. And so we had some hybrid development work looking at fuels and oxidizers that could be taken to very cold temperatures. And then we also looked at them for small satellite applications. We call them CubeSat applications, but it's like a JPL version, I would say, of CubeSats. An interplanetary version of CubeSats, where we're talking more like 12U, as sort of the smaller size we really consider. For a lot of the missions we were looking at. And for that, we were looking at, okay, how could we design a system that's going to be pretty safe since it would be a rideshare system? We really don't want to threaten the primary spacecraft. So how can we make a system that's very, very safe? Again, that has a storable fuel and oxidizer. And again, it was quite fun in that I was fresh out of my PhD program that had been doing development work on hybrid rockets, and now I was getting to apply that work to design, build, and test rockets on site at JPL, which was a really fun a really fun start to my professional career in the US. I now work on so that was more in the R&D world, which was great. There's a lot of freedom. You're responsible for a lot of parts of the process. I'm now working helping to lead a team that's designing the propulsion subsystem for the proposed Mars sample return campaign. And there we're actually looking at utilizing as much heritage as we can because we want to buy down risk as much as we can. But the spacecraft that we'd be trying to land is the biggest spacecraft that we've landed on Mars. So of course that comes through with comes with its own challenges. On that side, where we're on in sort of the design phase, I'm helping lead the analysis, or I lead the analysis of that subsystem. And so it's a lot more number crunching and things. It's less turning around hardware and iterating on hardware and test, and more, crunching numbers and working through initial design. So yeah, I think hopefully that summarizes where I'm at. I'm not
Yeah,
sure if
no.
that raises more questions than it answers, but.
Well, I mean, I guess it's interesting, because it's you want to you're using sort of more heritage, more established designs for the sample return. I guess that's because it's also you need to make sure it works. I mean, you can collect the samples, you can put them back in the return vehicle. But if it doesn't launch and it doesn't actually send it all the way back to Earth, it's a failed mission, right? It's not like a, that's real. Well, I mean, I guess it's all sort of like relative, but it seems,
Yeah, it's a challenge. I
you need to
mean,
get it to that point. And so you need to make sure that the rocket's going to work.
I should say as well, so the propulsion system that I've worked on there's two propulsion systems for the
Oh,
sample
okay.
return, which we don't normally deal with. We normally just deal with the one that lands you on Mars.
Right.
That is the one I am now focused on, but I also did some work system engineering on the Mars Ascent vehicle previously. Now I'm focused on our lander propulsion system. They're two completely different propulsion systems, which is enjoyable as a propulsion engineer because you get to learn about two completely different types of rocket. But you're right in that, yeah, in general, for these big missions where we're doing technology development, we need to have a really robust plan to ensure that that system is going to be as resilient as we can make it.
So for a
Because
smaller system like one of these CubeSats that you were talking about, those you can have sort of push the technological edge a little bit because it's a smaller stakes. But for something like this, where it's a multi-billion dollar investment, and it's you get I mean it really you need to make sure that it's going to work.
yeah, it's just a very different design process, I'd say. And the smaller systems, you've still got a concern depending on who you're riding share with. And as soon as you put propulsion as a ride share, there's a whole set of challenges there. But your challenges really are all focused on not causing harm to other areas of the launch vehicle and spacecraft. For something like a Mars lander, we try and do everything we can to think through all the different possible failure modes and buy down risk as much as we can ahead of time. And there's just a completely different scale in terms of the teams you're working with as well. So when you're doing R&D work, it tends to be a smaller team. You still need to have that technical alignment, but very different when you're working on something like Mars sample return campaign, where you have so many engineers potentially spread across the country, even with collaborations around the world. And so the ability to communicate actually becomes really key. And it's amazing how often that's overlooked, I think, in engineering. There's all those stereotypes about, oh, engineers can't really communicate. Well, actually, to be a successful engineer, I think you really need to be able to communicate, and particularly be able to communicate clearly where you've got uncertainty or where you may, you may need assistance. I think that's often, People think, oh, to be successful, you need to project confidence. Well, I actually think to be successful, you also need to be able to clearly communicate where you have risk and where you need help to buy that down.
That's a great point. And I think that's something that you're right, that people don't really think about. And but you're exactly right. You need to be able to communicate where you're vulnerable and where you need people to step in. Okay. Anyway, let's backtrack a bit, though. You've been working in the aerospace industry with your fellow engineers for your entire career. What in your life led you to where you are today? And did you always know that you wanted to work in space and space technology?
Yeah, I'll start out by saying when I started my engineering degree, I actually had no idea what engineering was. And I didn't know personally any engineers. So I was really driven by the desire to help with human exploration. I wanted to be an astronaut, but I think more so, I really wanted to help humans explore. I was sort of caught up in this idea of. I read Patrick Moore's Mission to the Planets, which was this gorgeous book talking about the missions that we'd done and what we'd learned about the other planets. And I just wanted to be involved in that effort. And I think that really spoke to me. I found out that Andy Thomas, he's a NASA astronaut, but also Australian. And so since I grew up in Australia, as people might gather from my accent, I found out that he had done mechanical engineering. So I was like, I had had some from the space field in Australia say, hey, you should consider mechanical engineering. And then I also had teachers, really wonderful teachers in math and science in high school. I knew I loved those topics. And they said, look, if you've got an affinity for this, you really should consider engineering. My brother as well. I guess I should say I did have one engineer. My brother went into engineering. He was a civil engineer. He's ended up more in finance. But he also spoke to me and said, look, your skill set seems like it would be aligned with engineering. And since I wanted to do space and things, I sort of ended up going into mechanical engineering, following in the footsteps of our Australian astronaut at the time, Andy Thomas. In Australia, though, double degrees are much more common. And so I did a science and engineering degree. And when I went into it, I thought that I wanted to be a scientist. I loved physics, and I thought that was going to be my path. And it was only once I, really dove into engineering, probably like my third or fourth year of undergrad, that combined degrees are 5-year degrees. So most of my final year engineering, all of my final year engineering classes were in my fifth year. And I only sort of realized right towards the end there that it was engineering that spoke to me much more than physics, actually. I loved the application of the physics to these problems rather than the pure physics itself.
That's me. I focus on in podcasts. I know that I am famously a physics and English double major, so which doesn't make any sense at all, but it
I
kind
love
of
it. That's
worked
even more
out.
you're studying.
Yeah. So let me just say, I think I speak for most people out in podcast land when I say that I am in awe of the engineers at JPL. I mean, you're a rocket scientist, right? And is there something about working at JPL that you could tell us that might be surprising to outsiders who are just like fanboys and fangirls?
One thing that I love about JPL, I love my colleagues, and I love that I think technical excellence is really prized and encouraged, and we're challenged to try to, work to be the most technically excellent version of ourselves that we can be. And I really love that environment. But I also love that for the most part, I think we do get to have a bit more balance at JPL. So the missions we work on are multi-year, and you know that right around when you've got a hardware delivery or, a test campaign or something like that, it's going to be really busy. And often we're very passionate about what we do. It becomes very all-consuming. But you also have phases where you can have a lot more work-life balance. And so most folks I work with are really passionate about hobbies and activities outside of work. So, in my case, I'm a whitewater kayaker. I love skiing, get to do a lot of those activities as well. And I think because we have that balance, it also opens up opportunities for other activities. So a lot of my colleagues help teach at universities. In my spare time, I co-wrote a textbook on hybrid rocket propulsion design. I'm not sure that as a mother with a 4-year-old, I would recommend that path. Again, I think I underestimated the amount of time it takes to write a textbook, but I do think the fact that we have sort of these more reliable timelines for our work opens up opportunities to explore other passions, which I think enriches a lot of the lives of those who work there.
Yeah, and probably makes it, you know, if I know, thinking about research engineers, and they spend years or careers on one topic, and I'm lucky because I get to do something new every week or every month. So having those outside interests must really sort of help to keep from getting burned out on just doing tackling the same project all the time.
Yeah, I think so. I think it generally, creates happier people, and happier people, I think we tend to be more productive when we're happy. I also think it can help with coming up with creative solutions. A lot of the engineering problems we deal with, by their very nature, it's sort of unique each time they come around. And so the more you can have a creative mindset, the better I think the results are generally going to be.
Cool. So let me ask you about something else. Yeah, as you mentioned, you're Australian. And Australia is a country that really, you know, punches above its weight in so many fields. I mean, you think about Australia, I forget how many people live there now, like 20, 30 million people, but it's like a California, but it really sort of, it has this international presence. But I admit I don't know enough about the STEM workforce pipeline in Australia. Does it in Australia, does it have as many problems finding enough technically trained workers there as we seem to have in the United States? And I'm not sure exactly how to put this, but are women encouraged, and are they given support to pursue that career path?
Yeah, I guess I'll start by speaking generally that we generally in a lot of the Western countries have a real pipeline issue with encouraging women to pursue STEM careers, and I think it happens at all phases. So we have issues, and apparently it starts very young. So primary school age, or elementary school, I guess we say here, age, it already starts. And I was really surprised. I did some outreach. So I did my graduate study at Stanford. I did my master's and PhD there, and we had this wonderful student-led program there called Young Astronauts, where we'd go into primary schools and volunteer. And the idea was that you'd teach these kids everything they needed to know to be an astronaut. But you'd cover a little bit of all different aspects of science and physics. And it was really fun, but it was amazing to me seeing the way these kids who were grade 3, grade 4, how there was already kind of a difference in how some of the females in the class interacted compared to the males in the class. And I really appreciated that a lot of my male colleagues also paid attention to it. And so we would occasionally have times where the people who went to the school just happened to be all male, right? You're drawing from a predominantly male skill set. And so we would try to just send whoever was available on any given month to the schools to participate. And when we only had male involvement, they noticed that a lot of the females in the class, sorry, and this is male volunteers leading it, they noticed that a lot of the females in the class wouldn't be as engaged. So we tried to make a real effort to make sure that we got one of the female graduate students to go and participate each time. And I just found it interesting that there was already that division at that age. And I also noticed that, unfortunately, and it's hard to know where these influences come from, but I would go and occasionally, the young girls would be more interested in how I did my hair than in tackling the engineering problem that we had at hand. And so I think in general, in order for us to change this, to turn this around and make a more equal, I think in general, most fields do better when we have more equal representation across the board. And so it's a matter of how do we improve the pipeline starting from that very young age all the way through. I was really lucky. I went to a Catholic all girls high school and had some wonderful teachers. I should say, actually, they were mostly male, but they were really encouraging. And they used to say things that I didn't understand at the time about, like, when you get out there, you're going to be working with a bunch of men. You push through and you show that you can do the job as well as any of them. And I thought, what are they talking about? Of course we can. And I only realized later how valuable that message was when I got to university and suddenly I was the only girl in hundreds of men doing some of these classes. And it was really wonderful to have some of that self-confidence, which had built for me from, I think, my schooling before the age of 18, and gave me the confidence to go into the university environment. And so, I think in general there's pipeline issues. I think we see it in both locations. I think it's a matter of encouraging people from a really young age and being careful with the language we use. I now try to be more aware of not saying, oh, just, to a little girl, I'm so tempted to say, oh, that's a beautiful dress. And I might say something like that. But I also might say, have you been reading any books that you love at the moment? Or, hey, do you have any cool Lego problems you've been solving? And follow it up with the same type of question I'd ask a little boy. I think we all have some unconscious bias and we have some work to do. But my hope is that things are going to move in the right direction. I actually say yes to requests to talk on podcasts like this, because the hope is that the more we get the word out that you can have this wonderful career, and you can be a well-rounded person having this career, and we're not all a stereotype that you might see on television of a male engineer who cannot communicate well and was not social and didn't have this really well-rounded, fulfilled life. There's actually a whole suite of amazing engineers who have a really balanced life and can be male or female or however you identify. And so, I think there's a challenge. I think the US and Australia are both at a point as well where we're sort of stagnated in progress, and so we need to tackle that. And it's something that I spend quite a bit of time thinking about. I don't have a solution yet, but I do try and make an effort to put myself out there in the hope that, if it inspires one other female, then wonderful. That was worth it.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, that's really all you can do. So before we go, I mean, speaking of girls in the STEM pipeline, my daughter is 15 and she's very interested in studying science and technology. I joke with her that she's going to get her Nobel Prize in astrochemical biophysics at some point. But if she came to you and asked for advice on how she could work for NASA in generally or specifically on systems like jet propulsion, is there like one sort of succinct bit of advice that you could give her?
Yeah, my general advice is to follow your passion and don't be dissuaded by a little bit of failure along the way. I think as long as you're pursuing your passion, and that could change over time, but it won't matter if your path has some twists and turns that you didn't foresee, as long as you have, your vision in mind that you're working towards. As a foreign national coming to work in the US and specifically getting a PhD in rocket propulsion, which has challenges in terms of ITAR, International Traffic and Arms Regulations, I was told at one point that I would never be hired at JPL. And JPL at the time was my dream job. If I had listened to that comment, which came from someone very senior, then I wouldn't be where I am now and doing the work that I love. Instead, I thought, okay. It's going to be hard for me, but I'm going to look for the one opening and try to work towards that. And if I don't get there, at least I would have had a fulfilled life doing things that I love. And so I think in general, it's a matter of trying to build some resiliency so you can handle five no's or 10 no's as long as you get the one yes at the end. And so, yeah, that's generally what my advice would be, is follow your passion and be prepared for some no's along the way because you just need the one yes.
That's excellent advice for both boys and girls and even people as old as me. But looks like we have to end it right here. Elizabeth Jens of Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Jeffrey. I've really enjoyed it.
And of course, thanks to everyone out in podcast land for listening in. If you'd like to hear more great conversations on a wide range of engineering topics, please subscribe to ASME TechCast on Spotify, iTunes, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. For ASME, this is Jeffrey Winters wishing you a great rest of your day. Thanks.